If you're in advertising or probably any creative business, at some point you're going to be the one responsible for coming up with the idea. Making that special something that turns strategy and research, meetings, gallons of coffee, into what the world actually sees. And when it's on you to pull out something great, it can help hearing from others who've been there too. And that's what this podcast is about. This is Have a Nice Idea. For this episode, we rolled up to Seattle to speak with Danielle Trevisano-Hawley, Chief Creative Officer at Possible. Amazing creative leader and all-around inspiring human. Check out her story now. Hi, Danielle. It's wonderful to meet you.
Thanks. You too.
So thanks for having us over here to the lovely offices of Possible here in Seattle. Looks lovely. We're sitting under some black velvet paintings. Not just one, but plural.
Many
of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And maybe after this, we'll get a tour and see your...
Sure, yeah. Yeah, my painting's up there. I was actually the first one.
Yeah, no big deal. Well, cool. You are our first female creative from the roots person that we've had on the podcast, and it's an honor. So
thanks.
Thanks for doing it.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Yeah, cool. Well, so let's start at the beginning, shall we? Talk about kind of where you came from, what got you into the business in the first place? Did you always kind of know you wanted to do this, or what? Tell us about that.
Well, I've always been a writer, so even when I was a little kid, I was writing. Young authors clubs. So I was constantly asking my mom to type things for me and then sew together the binding and wallpaper cover the outside, and getting my friends to illustrate things, and always loved telling stories, always loved writing. So that's been a part of me since I was a little kid. I can't really remember a time where I wasn't thinking about telling a story or writing something. And I was lucky to, I was a soccer player as a child, a pretty dedicated soccer player, and ended up going to Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas to play soccer, and had a great guidance counselor. The long and short of it is she listened to me for 15 minutes and said, well, you can't be a creative writing major because there isn't that tract. Do you want to be an English major? And I said, no, that's not really what I want to do. Or
right.
It doesn't sound fun really at all, even though, you know,
yeah, no
English
offense.
Lit. But no offense.
Right.
I didn't want to graduate with an English degree. And she said, well, have you thought about advertising? And Southern Methodist University has a really good communications program. And I just started in that program. But I think the program, of course, is media planning and advertising planning and research. And so it wasn't until, I would say, around my junior year of college where I really decided that I wanted to be a creative. And there were a few things that happened. One is I took an internship at the Richards Group in Dallas, Texas, at Richards Gravel, actually, which is the PR arm of the Richards Group, with a fellow teammate. One of my teammates was an account executive that had graduated and gotten a job there, and followed her around and really thought, this is absolutely what I do not want to do. The account side of things just did not appeal to me at all. And then coincidentally or not, I saw the Nike spot, If You Let Me Play. And I had never been so viscerally moved by advertising before. And if you think about it, here's this college kid who knows essentially two things about herself, that she's a soccer player and that she loves to write. And I had just was so moved by this ad and the fact that it was so breakthrough that I kind of was, you know, who wrote that? How do you get to do that? What is, you know, what can I do to understand more about it? And ended up writing an article in my school newspaper about the ad and what it meant to be a female athlete at the time and the stigmas around being a female athlete and the experience of having a lot of self-confidence from being a female athlete and what that felt like, what it felt like to be in that skin. And then just my lovely, beautiful, amazing teammate, Melissa Kittner, who's an account executive to this day, took me to a radio record. And that was it. I said, okay, I get it. This is what I want to do. And the really neat part of that story is that a few months back, I was at the 3% conference in New York, which Possible has been a sponsor of for many years. And Janet Champ was on the panel talking about how she created If You Let Me Play.
No way.
Way. And at the end of her panel, I took the mic and thanked her for that experience. And I guess everyone has Janet to thank for me being in this business, for better or worse. Uh-huh. And she came off the stage and found me in the audience and shook my hand and said, thank you. And now we're Facebook friends. So it's official.
Wow. Yeah.
That's so that was a really cool, like, full circle story and experience for me.
It doesn't get much better than that. That's pretty awesome.
It doesn't. And for the ad to have been written by a female, I think, even, you know, in 1996, we didn't have a whole lot of examples of female rock stars in the industry. We had Janet, we had her partner, Charlotte Moore, we had Sally Hogshead, we had Kara Goodrich, but other than that, you didn't really hear those names in the same breaths as you did, you know, Jim Ferguson and, you know,
Dan Wyden and all the,
just, and Cliff Freeman even at that time, you just didn't hear that many women. So it was extra special and interesting to meet Janet and to strike up that friendship.
What was her reaction to, like, hearing? I mean, I'm sure she's inspired a lot of other females and women. You
know, yes.
But to see the result of what she inspired you up on stage, you were in your position where you are, special was that?
I mean, she just thanked me. It was an endless conversation of thank you, no thank you, no thank you. But I think she was appreciative and moved. It doesn't get old, does it? Hearing that something that you've written has changed someone's life.
What was it like for them back in the day when there were probably even fewer female leads?
Janet told a story, and Charlotte Moore is the sister of Ron Moore, who is a Creative Circus longtime teacher at the Creative Circus. He teaches design. So we always sort of knew, I always sort of knew Charlotte's name as well. And not only was it interesting that the ad came from Janet, but that it was a female team. And that was really unheard of in her day. And she describes the experience of Dan sort of walking through the halls. It feels weird to call him Dan, for Dan, Mr. Wyden, to walk through the halls.
You can call him Dan.
And know that this brief had come across his desk and said, kind of peeked his head in their office and said, oh, you're girls. This is for Nike Women's Athletics. And I think that's probably that same tune. You'll hear that same tune a lot, that you got the women's brands. And I think that's certainly true of my own path. My partner right out of ad school was also a female. We were the only girls in our quarters of at the Creative Circus. So she actually graduated a quarter ahead of me in a quarter full of only men. And I graduated with 8 super, super talented men. And we kind of found each other in that environment and got hired in our next 2 jobs. And our experience was the same as Janet's. Is we have a Rocky Mountain clothing company in Denver, and it's a women's jeans brand called Cruel Girl, and you guys would be perfect for that. And such is the way it sort of went.
Which is kind of funny, because you couldn't write anything that might have a male audience, like, I don't know, coffee or cars, beer. Ladies, you can't do that.
And I since have. And I actually have a really interesting perspective on this. So much of it, I think, has to do with your interaction with the client rather than the execution of the ads themselves. Certainly men can write for women's products, and certainly women can write for a male-focused audience, but the interaction that you have with a client and being in the room expressing the ads from the point of view of that target audience, I think, is really powerful. And the other thing that I think is interesting is that more and more as social media is on the rise and you have community managers that are writers. I mean, they certainly are a different kind of writer, but they are writers. It is harder to write on the spot than it ever has been. So years ago, you would get I would get a brief for National Football League. I could research the hell out of everything that I needed to know about football and ultimately sound like just one of the guys.
Capture that voice, yeah.
Or a plumber, whatever I needed to sound like I could. These days, you know, if you're in that position of having to respond to a community that quickly, you can't, you know, turn around and open a book or Google till your heart's content to be able to respond to an audience that is are the experts. So I think that's a paradigm shift that's happening a little bit. That, you know, if you're managing a soccer community, you should probably have somebody that's super knowledgeable about soccer. If you're managing a coffee brand, you should have somebody that can talk about the best way to make a pot of French press on a dime. And that's, I think that's really interesting. That's a change, I think, that's happening.
Right. And it seems like there may be a change or a shift, or at least an addition to the, like you called them, you know, the writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's maybe a certain kind of writer that is really good on the fly like that, that either has the innate knowledge or experience that can write like that. But then the other writer that, can write a little bit more powerfully or evocatively, maybe?
There's nothing like the change that's happened, I think, in the last 10 years to our industry to create multifaceted creatives. And it's a challenge to think about that T-shaped talent of you not only have to be super deep in your craft, there's so many different types of writers now. There's so many different types of UX people. There's so many different types of art directors. And part of my challenge now in my role is because I oversee the 5 local offices in the Americas, is to build the right teams for clients. I have to know intimately the difference between, you know, 2 people who have the same job title, which is which is interesting and kind of fun. I guess it all rolls up to that problem-solving nature that we all have.
You mentioned that you're always into writing, but it sounded like you were also into, like, how your writing was presented. Were you always aware of what else can complement the words, or what the words are doing in addition to some other part of the communication?
Yes, absolutely. Looking back on it now, I was way more of a storyteller than I was an actual writer. I didn't want to write long prose. I have no half-written novel in my house somewhere. Right. It's not
no English major.
No, it was right. just it was it's that's very scary to me because I don't feel like that's my skill set. So that wrapper of everything that goes on, and I'm a crazy, you know, I analyze things to death. And I've always been that way. So figuring out what motivates people, figuring out why people do the things that they do, and having this sort of weird power to change their minds, as kind of fucked up and spooky as that kind of is, was always really appealing to me.
Yeah, okay. I can totally relate to that.
Yeah. My dad was in market research, too, so I don't know if that had any influence on me. But
probably. Something in your genes deep down, or somewhere in the chemistry, it's informing that, right?
I think strategy is a big part of many writers' lives too, even more so than it is from the design side or the art direction side. Writers really, you have less of a toolbox. So with design, you can pick up things and textures, and you can take photographs, and you can look at influence, and you can, start to draw. But with writing, you have Microsoft Word. That's not Photoshop or Adobe Creative Suite at all. So that strategy, you know, you really can't write until you know what you're writing about. I find the strategy still to this day is the thing that excites me the most. Mm-hmm. Because then when you sit down to write, you don't know where you're going to go. But without that foundation point, it's hard to start.
Would you say the attraction to the business today is still the same for you?
I think so. In many ways, yes. I think the thing that I love the most about the business now is the people. And it's part of the reason why I've been here for 7 years. Zaz was a web dev agency, and I was from the traditional world, having been a creature prior for most of my career before I came to Zaz. And I had never made a website in my life. And wanted to meet with Shane because we had mutual friends and because I had left Creature and decided that I wasn't good at this and didn't want to do it anymore, and just really felt like the industry wasn't for me. And quite honestly, met with Shane as a favor to my husband, who had introduced us. And I walked in the door, and he was really hungover, and he immediately told me that he was really hungover.
Good. Transparency.
Well, that's a big theme around here. And I, for some reason, said, "Well, me too." And we had both had our Christmas parties the night before. And we proceeded to talk for about an hour. And the first question that he asked me was, "What do you want?" And I don't know whether I was hungover or whether it was just a state of mind of having nothing left to lose, of just saying I'm done with this industry and it doesn't matter to me anymore. I put all my cards on the table and just said, this is what I want. I want more client interaction. I want more responsibility. I want to own things. I want to lead teams. I want to change your agency. I don't think that it makes sense that you're going to not be around in a few years if you are doing nothing but building websites. And we talked, and this we talked about the state of the industry, and we talked about how I could affect this place. And at the end of it, he ultimately said, when can you start? And that's it. This place has a very intrapreneurial spirit about it. I think the thing that I realized is I was really not interested in going to another agency that had everything figured out. I didn't want to be another cog in a wheel of an established place that was already doing good work. I felt like I could build something. And if you look at the history of where we were 8 years ago, this place is, we're killing it. And the creativity has finally caught up with the potential that we all knew we had. We've made some critical hires. We've won some critical accounts. And now it's like we're just getting started. So
now we're rolling.
Every year has been different and better. And so I think it's that people, that building of teams, and that puzzle of what happens when really smart, creative people come together. Beyond creatives, strategists, marketing sciences, gurus, search analysts, we all have a seat on the bus now. And I think the best agencies are really realizing that. The old adage of creative as king and only creative as king, I think is detrimental to the future of the industry.
Creative can still be king or queen, but it can be in any sort of outlet, right, that's under an agency.
And the inspirations, I think, come from different places than they once did.
Jumping back a second, you said, you know, before the hangover, and you were like at Creature, or you left Creature,
yeah.
You're like, I'm kind of done with this business. What were you feeling, or what was happening? Where were you mindset wise, like especially as a creative person?
I don't think I knew it then. But I owe so much to Matt Peterson and Jim Haven. They literally gave me an opportunity as a junior that no one else gets. They were small, and they recognized that they did not have a lot of money to spend on talent, and they found Miranda Gerlach, who's my partner, Miranda Gerlach-Dean, who's a creative director at YNR in New York, and I, right out of school, actually we had one job prior, but we were young, and we were new, and we were very green, but we were a little more mature. We could present, and they had no problems with us being in front of their clients because they saw that in us. And that was spectacular because we were able to really have ownership over the things that the accounts that we were handed. And at the time, it was the four of us. We were the only creatives in the building. So we got a crash course from two of the best creatives in the business. And we were building our own pitch decks from the get-go. So if you fast forward 13 years, 14 years later, I'm still young. I still feel pretty new to the business. But I've been able to do a lot in a really short amount of time because I kind of got put on warp speed to catch up. So I think the reason that it was that I had gotten to that tough spot was burnout. You know, when you're a small agency like that, and you're working 80-hour weeks for 4.5 years.
Yeah, it gets kind of addicting.
Ugh,
and then
it's totally addicting.
You hit the wall.
Hit me with the needle. But I was also at a different place in my life. I wanted to get married. I knew that I couldn't envision doing what I was doing there and having a family. It just didn't. Suddenly the future just wasn't clear to me. I've also always sort of struggled with, it's actually until recently that I think I've really felt my feet under me in the sense of, I've always had lots of really good skill sets, but being the best, most talented creative in the room, I've never felt like that person. Maybe it was because of the 8 guys that I was in the room with back at the Creative Circus who were super funny, who always came up with the craziest idea, who always sort of stole the show, that I always relied on things like my presentation skills or my keen strategy brain or the fact that I could write myself out of problems. And quite frankly, my MO has always been, well, I'll just outwork you. So I relied on those things rather than just what I feel is natural talent. Some people just have that. I've never feel like I have that to rely on as much as some other people. So it was, I think it was easy for me to fall into a place where I said, well, I'm not really that good at this anyway, so I'm just gonna, you know, go to cooking school, which I probably should have done.
It strikes me, though, that I think some of the best, most talented creatives are also the ones that are the most self-deprecating, the most unsure of their own abilities, and it therefore can, in a lot of ways, make them work harder or I don't know, it's a funny thing that I've run into in talking to different creatives.
It's like chasing your tail.
Yeah. And then you look up all of a sudden and you're like in this position and people are looking up to you saying, oh, she's the best creative, she's the best writer or whatever it is. And it's just, it's funny. Just FYI.
Well, I hope that's true. I don't know if I'll agree with you, but I'll hope that's true.
Okay.
Just because then I have to admit that I'm the best creative, which I'm never going to do.
No, right. Yeah, and as soon as you do that, you're dead. Don't ever admit that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the value of I'll outwork you or I will outpresent you or whatever. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from? Because that is also vital. You can have the best ideas, you and your team, amongst you four people or whatever, can have the greatest idea, but if the client doesn't buy it or it doesn't get through the agency, is it still a great idea, you know, that kind of thing?
I think it's absolutely been the key to my success. I don't know if I can necessarily say where it comes from.
Yeah. Did you learn it from anybody or did you?
You know, I don't know. Most of the things that I do now, I've been doing for my whole life. And I have memories of, you know, reading, being the one that the teacher always called on to read out loud. Being the one that was chosen to present something in class when it was Grandparents' Day or whatever. I think it's just, maybe that's the natural talent. That's the thing that I can't describe, that I've just always been able to do and always felt comfortable doing. The outworking thing, I think, is it goes back to being an athlete. You know, I never, I grew up in a really, really hyper affluent town, where my public high school was essentially like a boarding school. And there were some really smart kids. And it was a very high pressure situation. There was like 33 kids in my graduating class that applied to Boston College. I mean, you're not getting in. When there's 33 kids applying to the same school, they're gonna take the top three. So that feeling of never being quite the best. I didn't have the best SAT scores. I didn't have the best grades. I was a soccer player, and that was the thing that was going to get me where I wanted to go. That's always been my context. And my mom always sort of just said, all you can do is what you can do. So that that sort of underlying theme of if you try as hard as you possibly can and you lose, you can walk away because you tried as hard as you can and you can trust that it's okay. And that stays with me, that you put it all on the field and you can feel good about whatever the outcome. And it's when you don't, or when something got in your way, or you let someone's voice get in the way of the idea, or you weren't true to the beliefs that you had in the beginning, that those are the things that keep you up at night. Those are the things that keep me up at night.
Yeah, that you just can't let go, and therefore you're like, God, I didn't leave it on the field, you know?
Yep.
I want to do over.
I wish there were mulligans in this business. I wonder how procurement would feel about mulligans.
Yeah, maybe we could write that into our contracts. Let's try it. Well, let each other know how that goes. How's that thing with procurement and the do-over clause? What's some other stuff that stuck with you that, like, was...
Truth, the Truth campaign. I think I've had the pleasure of working with Alex Bernard since his Crispin days. And the thing that stuck out to me that I think changes a lot, and it sticks with me today, is it wasn't an anti-smoking campaign. they called it internally at Crispin an anti-manipulation campaign. And I thought that was so smart that they knew that telling kids not to smoke was not going to work. So they what they preyed on was children's ability or kids' ability, teenagers' ability to hate when people were trying to manipulate them. And that was what they thought the tobacco industry was doing, which is just fascinating. And then the execution of the work was so shocking. And it wasn't advertising. It didn't feel like advertising. It felt like something else. Of course, it was advertising, but it wasn't a print ad. It wasn't, you know, showcased in CA. It created a whole new doorway into what I guess you would have called at that time guerrilla-style advertising, of doing stunts and events that shook up the industry. And at Creature, we had a saying that we would say the best media space you could buy was inside someone's mind. And that was sort of our way of introducing a client to, you came here, you asked us for banners, or you asked us for wild postings, or you asked us for a radio spot or whatever, but what you really need to do is sort of back up and say, it could be anything. And that really helped me when I made the jump to digital, because I already thought that way. I'd have thought sort of media agnostic, platform agnostic. I had that ability to think that way, and then all I had to do was learn the platforms that were best suited to the execution. So the truth is a really big one for me.
It sounds like you have some pretty high standards for yourself. And
who told you that?
What? I didn't.
Did I tell you that? Is that what you're gleaning from this conversation?
I'm picking it up.
Yeah.
Google did not give me that, but I'm starting to get.
It's been a long time since I've Googled myself. Do I need to?
Nothing crazy on the first page.
Okay.
So you're safe.
All right. yes, I have very high standards for myself and for probably everyone around me.
Which is a good thing. This is all good.
Yeah, I think that it's the same thing that I mentioned earlier, though. If you're working really hard, I'm okay with less than perfection, if you will. But if you're really taking the easy way out or not asking the right questions or not being relentless in the pursuit of finding your solution, then I have a problem. Someone once, I actually mentioned this on another podcast earlier, but someone once described me, we have this thing at Possible, which I think is really cool, where sometimes we'll let, if you and I were in a pitch room, I would introduce you because I can brag about you in front of the client. Where if you introduce yourself, it's sort of hard to say like, well, I've won all these awards and blah, blah, blah. It's just awkward. But I can say Andy is, you know, compassionate and really insightful. I can say all those things in front of a client. And we did that once. And the director of marketing sciences here, global director of marketing sciences here, Jason Carmel, said, this is Danielle Trevisano-Hawley, and she has no patience for mediocrity. And I was like, whoa. It was just so bizarre to have someone say that about you and to hear that. It took me by surprise, but I suppose it's true.
You know, I think probably after a while he's worked with you long enough that that he's probably gathered that too.
Yeah, and I think that especially in digital and especially at our agency, there's so many different disciplines and capabilities that go into our secret sauce that when we're firing on all cylinders, it's fun. So I think that standard comes from just like, if I'm not having fun, why are we doing this? So that sort of relentless nature is really in the pursuit of fun.
What feeds that? Like, where do you go for inspiration for yourself, or how do you keep that fun quotient fresh for others?
I think that's like the pot of gold. I think we're all searching for how to keep it fresh and fun, and ideas are kind of endless. You just never know what someone's going to say that's going to all of a sudden change your train of thought and put it in a completely different direction. Or we have this weird thing, or I have this weird thing where every time we sort of nail down a pitch strategy, all of a sudden the universe will start talking to me. I'll see we pitched Xbox a few years back, and we uncovered this insight of, well, really, people hate gamers. They get frustrated with gamers. They don't hate gamers, but they get frustrated with the gamer in their life, right? Just as much as I get frustrated with the football lover in my own life. and Xbox was launching this entertainment side of their business, and it was finally this chance for sort of everyone to get something out of Xbox, rather than just sort of resenting the gamer in their life. And we just broke this insight along that line of thinking, and then literally log into my Facebook page to do something unrelated. And there's a picture of my friend with her glass of wine in her pajamas talking about how excited she is to watch her husband play video games all night. And of course, she was being completely sarcastic. But you all of a sudden see that. You hear the universe starts to tell you, yeah, you're right. If you open that door, all of a sudden you start hearing things that make it true.
Yeah,
and they make it real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Little nugget.
And conversation. I think that's super important. And what we do now, we used to call it word of mouth, and we would like it was in the ether. But now it's you can measure it, you can see it, you can listen to it, and you can scour the internet for the social conversation that's happening. And if you can tap into that conversation, you've got something really special. So,
would you say is some of your favorite work that you've ever done personally, or that you've been a part of, and maybe what made it that way? Giant question.
No, it's actually a pretty easy answer. I have two. That's okay. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think people would be surprised that I don't name one of them. But A Creature, we did the launch campaign for season 2 of Big Love. I don't know if you guys remember that show on HBO. And at the time, I was obsessed with the show long before we had gotten the brief. And for people listening that don't know about Big Love, it's a show about polygamy. And that was another really tough sort of insight to crack of how are we going to get people to watch the show? And ultimately, what we decided was that the show had this really uncanny way of drawing you into thinking that their life was normal. So for the first, 25 minutes, 30 minutes of the show, you'd be thinking, sister wives. Yeah, like, I kind of want a sister wife. That'd be cool. Like, free babysitter, and, like, you could, like, someone to cook with and chat with. And then instantly something would happen on the show that would sort of break you out of this experience and go, no, that is very, very wrong. And we wanted the advertising to have that same effect. So what we did was we created ads that targeted polygamists. So the average consumer would be driving down the road and see a bulletin board, for a perfume, just like something you would normally see, like scantily clad model, beautiful bottle of perfume, but it would be for Ode to Polygamy. And the tagline said something like, set yourself apart from his other wives. So it was this, this experience of you're drawn into an ad that you would see every day that didn't feel unusual. And then all of a sudden you'd be jolted out of this experience and go, no, that's what just happened to me. So that campaign was...
Seems entirely normal, but...
Was so not.
Yeah.
So when we actually made the perfume. We actually made Ode to Polygamy and gave it out as samples and...
You have to. That's awesome.
Yeah, and we made pillows that we sold in furniture stores that said, like, God bless our legal family, and just really funny. I'll never in my life get a chance to have a client be like, that headline, God bless my legal family, is brilliant. It was really something else to be a part of that.
Right.
And at one point on one of the shoots, we were writing alternate endings to the ads, and it was very interesting to experience the client kind of saying, no, you can't write that because it's too much of a hint about what's about to happen in season 2, which also was kind of neat because we started writing alternate endings hoping that we could get the client to tell us what was about to happen. And as fans of the show, that was kind of funny. And then the second one is the Periscope campaign that we just did for Saint Germain. Where we did a peep show on Periscope. And I think the reason that was so fun was it was this crazy uncharted waters of what Periscope was and how to use it and how we were going to shoot and how do you do that on a phone and what director was going to take that risk and what actress was going to be okay with a live situation in which she was, essentially taking off her clothes, and how was that going to work, and where we were going to push the sexuality, and I loved it because the set itself was like a Wes Anderson film. The set that Believe Studio built was so beautiful, and it was like this tiny little world that got brought to a live audience via an iPhone, which was just, it was just magical. And it was one of those days where we held hands with the client and we held hands with each other, all female team, by the way, female director, female production lead, two female creative directors, myself, and female clients, which is nuts. Totally nuts. Yeah.
Like the planets and all sorts of stuff were aligning on this. I mean, yep. So much new stuff, like new technology, new channel.
You got it.
Everything.
New kind of team, new everything. It was one of those days where we, at the end of it, all sort of looked at each other and couldn't believe that nothing had gone wrong. And I don't think I'll ever experience a shoot like that. I don't even know if I can call it a shoot. It was the most bizarre part of that experience was not having to go into an edit bay for 3 weeks afterwards.
It
was done, which was so weird. And I think pretty indicative of the way things are going to be moving forward.
That team,
yeah.
All female. Was that purposeful or was that, I don't know, was there a strategy?
It wasn't. There were members of the team that weren't all female, certainly, but the core group was female, which was strange. And it was, the majority was female. So not just the creatives, the media gals and the content strategists and everyone. We would be in meetings and all of a sudden look around like, this is bizarre. We would take panoramic photos of the conference room because it was just so strange to have us all in one room like that. It was intentional from the perspective of I chose the right team for the job. Honestly, that was the... I hate having this conversation and I love having this conversation because it's so tough to have awesome work be out there and not be able to just talk about the work for the work's sake and to actually have to back up and say, by the way, did you know that an all-female team did it? It's a strange dichotomy. The same thing happened to me when I got promoted. It was like, you know, there's a handful of CCOs that are women, and Shane kind of said, we're not going to talk about that because you're a badass and I don't want anybody, you know, thinking anything less. But at the same time, I have this sense of responsibility to talk about it because it needs to change. And the only way to change it is to make sure that we're having these conversations. So Nicole McDonough is a beautiful writer and she has a sort of elegant femininity to her work. So she was perfect for the role as creative director. And Carol Chapman comes from digital. So she's very knowledgeable and comfortable in an environment where she doesn't understand a platform and she has to sort of dive in and figure out how does Periscope work and what do we need to know about it. And then we had, you know, these amazing women on the periphery who were super inquisitive, who weren't afraid to ask a ton of questions, who were okay with not being the experts, which I think is, you know, analogous to stopping and asking for directions in a lot of ways. Not that men don't stop and ask for direction, but, you know, there is that. You have that reputation. And then it was really important because of the nature of the content that the client understood our vision was to actually speak to both men and women and walk that perfect line of elegance and beauty without sort of tipping the scales to sexuality. Right. I mean, if we push the sexuality too far, we would end up in, you know, underwear commercial land.
Right.
But if we didn't push the sexuality far enough, we would have ended up boring. So that was a really interesting situation. And then the live comments. We were so fearful of the community revolting. And we didn't know very much about the Periscope community at the time. Half our strategy was about getting people to download Periscope, which is a whole conversation for another time. But we were expecting people to have a problem with the content of the peep shows. There wasn't one. Not one single troll. It was 97% positive sentiment. The backlash that we got was people didn't believe it was live.
Too good to be live. That's nuts.
Too high of a production value and like nothing anybody had ever seen on Periscope, so they just didn't believe it was live. But we had Hannah wear an earpiece so Floria could As people were commenting on the live feed, Floria could say, "Hey, Hannah, turn around and wink at the camera." So we created this intimate experience between the audience and Hannah in live, so that if you were the one that said, "Hey, Hannah, wink at me," and then she turned around and winked at you, you had a one-to-one real-time engagement with the talent, which was nuts. Right? It's like nuts.
Usually you have to pay for that.
Right?
Okay. Wow. That's mm-hmm. amazing. What a cool balance, though. Mm-hmm. Like, I like that you were talking about that balance of, you know, push it too far and it's all about sex. Push it not enough and it's too female or you know, can be too either way.
And I think that's why it was so important to have females on set, because it's, you know, it wasn't scripted. So we had to rehearse, and Hannah had marks, and she had, you know, things she was going to do and not going to do. And I think in this case, it was extremely important to have a feminine take on what was too far and what was not far enough.
You mentioned the 3% conference.
Yeah.
Is that the right name?
Yeah.
Okay. I know of it. I know what its purpose is. I don't know that much about it, certainly from the inside, because dude.
Yeah. Well, it's not a conference for women. That's the first thing you should know. It's a conference for everyone. Kat Gordon, who's the founding member of the 3% movement, really just was a creative director at her agency in California, and just sort of looked around and said, this is not okay anymore. And she uncovered a statistic that was, you know, 80% of purchasers are women. And it just felt so wrong to her that so few people in advertising were women speaking to this audience that was, you know, these consumers who were largely, you know, driving purchases. And she started a conference and just sort of said, let's talk about it. 3% stands for the percentage of women who hold a creative director title or above. I think it's now 13%, and you should check the website for the perfect statistic there. But it is changing and it is getting better. But still, I mean, 13%, 14%, whatever it is still pretty tough. And the conference is magical. I mean, I think it's this last year it really found its footing, and it's been through its sort of ebbs and flows. This was the fourth year that the conference has happened, and we got all of the stuff that we had to sort of talk about out of the way. You know, what kind of policy should we institute for women? Why is it so hard? What can you do in the room? Stop saying like, stop saying I'm sorry, stop saying so. All these things that we could just sort of do to motivate each other and help each other in these settings that were so largely dominated by men. And we kind of got all that out of the way, and this year was really about the work, and hence opening with Janet. And talking about the work, the beautiful, amazing work that's happened from women, and really kind of peeling apart, you know, why they did what they did and how. This year was very motivating and very inspiring.
Yeah, it sounds pretty powerful. Like you said, it's found its footing, it's found its larger purpose, other than, not that it's not unimportant, you know, the HR things and like rules and regs and best practices.
Right.
Now let's move on to the inspiring stuff.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I don't think I would have ever had that experience with Janet without an environment or, you know, a place for that to happen, which was really special to me. It was a highlight.
Nice. Well, it sounds like it's something that needs you to be a part of it for a long time coming, you know?
I think it needs all of us, and we took 18 people this year from Possible. We've sponsored for the last 3 years, and I think 50% of the people that we took this year were men. It's still, I mean, our global creative council is just me in a sea of men. It's tough, and I think it needs all of us to change it, not just the women who are doing it. But I think it goes back to those examples. Of having the Susan Creedles of the world and having, you know, people who are doing it and who are managing families and who are managing a life, not just a career as a female at that level.
Right, but you're also hiring other females and nurturing them. And
yeah.
I mean, one thing you said earlier that I'm glad you brought it up and put on the table, because it is that awkward discussion of... this was created by males, this was created by a mixed team, this was created all female team, but can we just talk about the work? Is obviously how it should be, but it is worth, I don't know, uncovering, you know, some about who is doing it and how they got into the positions they are. So it's...
Yeah, Kat's line is diversity equals creativity equals profitability. And I think that's true. And it almost is like if you took gender out of it entirely and talked about the skill sets of the people involved, which I think is so fascinating, that you would you just really need to sort of force yourself into that equation of who is the right person for the job. But I also feel like that's a very female minded perspective, because I will really do that, where this industry has proven habits, and old habits die hard, and like hires like, and there are going to be a lot of men who are going to staff that assignment with a whole lot of other men, likely a lot of white men. Which, you know, I think is a disservice to the work.
Are there any things that stand out as being things that get you out of bed in the morning instead of keep you up at night?
The people are still the thing that gets me out of bed. I was listening to some others talk between the conference and between a visit that I just took to the Creative Circus, and I think the perspective of we're not doing very important work. We're not. I mean, does anybody really need more stuff? But it's fun, and it's a problem-solving type-based approach to lots of things. So I think what's interesting to me is how that skill set and being able to craft that skill set and hone in on that skill set has sort of helped me with life, including being able to have enough perspective that, you know, getting somebody to buy a coffee is not, you know, saving lives or changing the world, really. I love the idea that we get to impact culture, and I love the beauty that comes out of people because of how we inspire them. So that's what I think. I think that it's what keeps me going. I don't know if you guys have ever felt this, but I'll just put it on the table. It can this year even. There felt like there were so many products that were for social good, that everything was hell bent on sort of being about changing things for the better. And not that I don't support and believe in that altruism, but it almost is tipping to the point of it being inauthentic. Yeah. That we're doing those types of assignments, or that we're looking for those kinds of solutions because we'll win awards. And I'm hoping that we can get back to that balance of, you know, it's totally okay that we are in a business that sells things, and that's our job, and impacting culture and influencing behavior is our job. Yeah. And it's fucking fun, and I want to do it for a really long time. But the perspective of sometimes we can change the world, we should. But that we should do it because we can, not because we're going to get a trophy out of it.
Yeah. Very well said. I was actually going to ask you about award shows and awards in general. Like
necessary evil.
Yeah. You know, they're obviously rewarding to the creative soul of the person that invests their time and soul in producing a solve. But have you seen any other benefits, let's say, of awards?
I think it solidifies teams. So certainly the thing that I've seen from the team that won the Gold Lion for the Collective Project this year for the Robert Downey Jr. Viral video. I mean, that poor team. What a lot of people don't know is that that was one video in 360 pieces of content that they created to support that one video. So when our amazing account guy sat in the lobby of Marvel until they finally took the meeting so that we could get RDJ on board, was amazing and powerful. And we knew that we had lightning in a bottle, and the second that it launched, and within minutes, we had enough views that we knew that it was going to go through the roof. But the coolest part of that story was not just that 90 million people saw that ad, was that we retargeted all of those 90 million eyeballs, or times 2 million eyeballs, with content that actually drove them lower funnel. So those 365 pieces of content that were supporting the retargeting effort that happened, you can imagine what it did to that team. And they were doing something that had never been done before with that sort of retargeting theory and the way that they use media and optimization and data to orchestrate all of that. And they were here. I mean, they completely devoted their summers. They were sleeping under the tables. It was exactly the environment that you expect of an ad agency. And so for them to win, they have a bond now because they didn't just create an amazing piece of work or an amazing campaign. They did something that no one's ever done before. And they feel that, and it's bonded them, I think, for sure. They're like little soldiers or like a little platoon.
That's so awesome.
They've been to battle.
Yep. But that's a lot of what this business is about, I mm-hmm. feel like on the inside. It's like, mm-hmm. yeah, we made it through there. We fucking survived. We owned it. Good.
So Wurchos, I think, do that. And I also think they have their rightful place in being sort of advertisements for agencies. The one thing that we struggle with here is just knowing how much talent is in this building and how few people know, including clients. And that's starting to change, and it's been changing for the last, I would say, 2 years, really, that we've, as possible, have really hit our stride. But it's still, you know, I still sat on a panel with Chloe Gottlieb at RGA, who looked over and said, I don't know who Possible is. Now, whether she was telling the truth or not, who knows? But that's frustrating to me. And award shows are a way that you change that.
Well, this has been so amazing talking to you.
Good.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Danielle.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Hope you liked this episode of Have a Nice Idea. You can go to haveanniceidea.com anytime and hear from other advertising rock stars, or listen in on iTunes and SoundCloud, too. I'm Andy Askren, and I want to thank Digital One for their help in making this recording possible. Check them out at digone.com. Good? Great. Now get out there and have a nice idea of your own.